Hear argument in our second case, number 102404, Minnesota Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company versus Antonelli Terry Stout Krause. Mr. Burke.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Lon Burke, and I represent the Antonelli Law Firm and Mr. Donald Stout. This is the second time we've been before Your Honors, some of Your Honors, on this matter. Initially, we had sought to stay the lawsuit commenced by the insurance company. That was unsuccessful. And so the question now presented to the panel, and which was presented to the district court below, is whether or not there is a duty to defend both the law firm, or either the law firm, and Mr. Stout. And the test, very simply, as this court has already held in connection with the motion to stay, is whether any of the allegations, if proven in the underlying plaintiff's complaint, would generate a liability that's covered by the insurance policy. Here, the district court plainly found that there were such allegations. It found that to give a little background of the complaint, to remind the court, this arises out of relates to the technology that underlies the BlackBerry device. It was contended by the plaintiffs that the email wireless technology underlying the BlackBerry device was invented by a company called Telefind. And they were advised not to document their interest in this invention. And as a result, the patent was filed by ESA Telecommunications and later transferred to an entity called NTP. And the claims against my client is that they advised Telefind and its investors not to document their interest in this patent so that in connection with a litigation by another company altogether, LeaseCo Computer, I believe it's called, they would not have those assets seized. And the plaintiffs contend they followed that advice, they relied on that advice, and as a result, they lost their interest in the patents. The district court found that those allegations were contained in the complaint, and therefore it stated the complaint triggered the duty to defend. However, the district court erred by going further and reading other allegations that were contained in the complaint to contend that there was an exclusion, the so-called business pursuits or business enterprise exclusion, applied. And there are at least two things wrong with the reasoning of the district court and why we requested it be reversed. First is the test in every case from CACI that this court decided, Fewis that this court decided, Parker versus Continental decided by the Virginia Supreme Court, is that if any of the allegations in a complaint, if proven, would lead to a liability covered by the policy, then you have to defend the whole complaint, whether or not there are other allegations that, if proven, might trigger an exclusion.
Excuse me, did you just tell me that the district court said that there was a duty to defend here?
No, the district court found that...
No. But I think you did. I think what if we had the record read back.
Oh, I said it triggered the duty to defend, but then the district court went further and found that that duty was abrogated by the exclusion. In other words,
I
may have misspoken.
So there is no duty to defend.
Right, and that's why we're appealing. If there were a duty, we would not be here.
All right.
Okay, I apologize.
No.
What I meant to say is that the district court found that this was within the coverage provision of the policy. In other words, there were allegations of legal advice.
I thought you were making a distinction between the duty to defend and the duty to indemnify, but you were not. You were making a distinction between the policy and the exclusion.
Yes. Okay. And so the district court found that there were some allegations that triggered the policy coverage agreement, but that because there were other allegations that triggered an exclusion, There was no duty to defend. And our point is that that's not the law in Virginia. The law is if any allegations if proven, create a duty to indemnify, then the insurer has to defend the entire complaint.
Aren't you asking us really to consider the fact that he gave legal advice, consider that fact in isolation without considering the content of the legal advice? Because the legal advice did relate to the business enterprise, didn't it, and how they handled the NTP affairs and exactly how the individuals should proceed during this period where they were lying low, so to speak. So how can we view the legal advice as being separate? Don't we have to consider what the content of the legal advice was? And then how do you get beyond the fact that the legal advice related to the business enterprise that Stout was involved in?
Well, the legal advice, let me take that in two steps, Your Honor. I agree that you have to consider the content of the legal advice here. And the legal advice, allegedly, of course my clients deny that it was given, was not to document certain interests in patents and to permit ESA Telecommunications to file those patents. Once they followed that legal advice, that was the end of the ballgame. So the plaintiffs didn't have an interest in the patents any longer. So the business enterprise, if one existed, that Mr. Stout was involved in, and let me get to the business enterprise issue in a moment, would have been a company that was formed well after the advice was rendered. So the point that I'm making is that the plaintiffs, if their allegations are right about this this advice, would have suffered a harm already at the time of the enterprise. So you never have to get to this enterprise issue, and the court shouldn't have gotten to the enterprise issue. In other words, if the plaintiffs were to stop their case and their allegations at the allegation regarding ESA Telecommunications, end of story, that would be enough of a claim that, if proven, would result in coverage under the policy, because they would have relied on this legal advice that was incorrect. Now, what the district court did, which was error, I believe, was it basically went to the business enterprise formed after the legal advice was given and after the harm, if there was any harm, was done by ESA getting the interest in these patents, and yanked it all the way back to the beginning by saying that there was some scheme, by finding that there was some scheme to do down the road what the plaintiffs alleged happened. But there's no reason, the plaintiffs could very well not prove that that scheme existed. And in fact, at the time that the legal advice was given, it was in everybody, if the plaintiff's allegations are right, it was in everybody's interests, including the plaintiffs, not to document this invention.
But when that advice was given, weren't the lawyers investors?
That's unclear from the allegations, actually, Your Honor, because...
It's not unclear from the pleading.
I believe it is, because what it says is that they owed money and they were forgiving legal fees. Investors.
Yes,
I'm sorry. I misheard. Yeah. Yes, but being an investor is not sufficient to fall within the language of the exclusion. You have to be a manager, an owner, or a controller, not merely an investor. There are other exclusions in the business enterprise. There are other exclusions.
Turn some of their investment into equity?
I'm not sure they did in Telefund at the time.
They planned that at some point they had turned some of their loan into equity.
Well, but that makes them a shareholder, not an owner or manager. There are other exclusions if the insurer...
Owner is a shareholder.
Well, I do not believe the complaint allegations are clear. And even if that allegation is contained in there, that's an allegation that has to be... that need not be need not be proven with respect to the legal advice claim. In other words, the legal advice was given to an entity, Telefind, which the judge in the district court, or to the investors in this entity, Telefind, with the judge in the district court, found it was dubious as to whether that entity, they had any interest in that entity, sufficient to trigger the business enterprise exclusion. And so the judge found below, and I think the insurance company will admit that as to Telefind, it's not clear from the complaint that it falls within the exclusion. The only way you get back to the exclusion is to find that the business enterprise is this long-winded, long tail from 1980 to 2001 scheme, which my clients obviously deny existed, and which the plaintiffs don't even have to establish existed in order to have this claim on legal advice, which is what triggers the policy. So, Judge Gregory, I think I answered your question on that. If I didn't...
You did.
Okay.
I'll tell you a question I have. Maybe you can think about it when you're sitting down in rebuttal. It seems to me that what you say is that this is a case like one in which somebody pleads an intentional tort, but if they succeed on a tort, if in the underlying case there's no proof of intention, there would still be recovery. And so we would say that the insurance company, if it only covers non-intentional torts, would still apply. That I think is a Virginia law, and that's basically law everywhere I know about. But when we look there, we look at a complaint in which one cause of action, a lesser cause of action, is pled. And that's not what we have here. I don't think you've cited us a case in which, I'm talking about the underlying suit.
Parker,
here.
Your Honor.
Sorry?
I cited the Parker case.
Okay, tell me about Parker.
That is a trespass case.
Sir?
I'm sorry.
Can I ask a question first?
Yes, I'm sorry.
You say that it has an independent cause of action that is that what you're telling me, that is not negligence and intention. It's something else.
No, it is negligence.
Well, there you go.
But tell
me something else, some other one.
No, I guess I don't know of a case off the top of my head.
Well,
that case involved, I'm sorry.
We're not just asking you on top of your head.
Right.
You've had a long time to brief it, right?
No, that's true. And I don't know a case. I didn't find a case that is exactly on all fours with this.
I'm not asking on all fours. You do understand my question.
Well, there are cases where the business pursuits exclusion is asserted, but the court finds that because there's questions about it, that there's still a duty to defend.
Every one of the causes of action here would be excluded by the business pursuits exception.
That is what, okay.
Would you just bear with me as a hypothetical?
Okay.
Okay, but some of the individual numbered paragraphs might not be, but they're not included within the causes of action at the end. So do you have a case that's like that?
Well, the individual allegations, yes, I do.
Okay.
And that's the Parker case, and I will tell you about that. It was a case for intentional trespass, no count for negligent trespass.
But under the state law, if you alleged intentional trespass, you got the benefit of non-intentional trespass. There's no comparable state law here, is there?
Well, I think there might be.
Okay. That's on legal
malpractice. If you cross out every allegation in there except for the allegations regarding the legal advice, and you keep the count in, you would still have a breach of the fiduciary duty, which was part of the attorney relationship. That's why the law firm's in the case in the first place, because they are contending that Mr. Stout acted as a partner of the law firm. And so if they prove that the if they prove, which they I strongly believe they won't be able to prove it because it's ultimately false, but that needn't concern us, that this legal advice was given and that Mr. Stout acted as their lawyer and they relied on him to do that, then the breach of fiduciary duty count would survive. And so that's all they have
but
to prove.
Not if all of the advice they gave him was included within this business exclusion. If all of this advice was...
But the district court found it was not, because the advice related to Telefind, and he found, the district court, that Telefind, it was dubious whether there was that relationship with that company. He only got to the business pursuits exclusion because he yanked back everything into the past when the advice was given.
All right. Thank you. You have some time left for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Howell? Maybe you can start where your colleague ended, just so I can remember the point. And that is, he seems to say that there is a separation, there is, by at least the district court concluded, that there was malpractice separate and apart from that covered by the business practices exclusion.
I don't know, with respect, what part of the district court's opinion that would be found in. The opinion is in two parts. The first merely rejects the argument we made below that there was no provision of professional services that would even come within the policy. There was no separate determination that there was somewhere pled in the 100 or more paragraphs of the third amended complaint in the case below some separate act of legal malpractice, which, by the way, isn't pled at all, separate and apart from the scheme. The scheme is where everything started. The advice to not assert, not document an ownership interest was given part and parcel with the plan to ultimately transfer assets to a company that Mr. Stout would, in fact, form. And the district court made a special note of that, that this was always the plan. There is no separate allegation that would support a recovery of damages in this complaint as it is pleaded simply from the standpoint that an attorney somehow gave a client advice, don't document your interest, and they didn't do it, and now they have damages. Each one of the causes of action that are asserted in the Third Amendment complaint relies on the assertion of the scheme. The first is a breach of fiduciary duty. It's a breach of trust. There was a promise to the Ferguson plaintiffs that if you come with us on this plan, then you will share in the largesse after the dust has settled, as the complaint put it, in the effort to avoid the execution by the Jet Creditor Lease Co. The second cause of action, there is an allegation of breach of contract. Well, if that's all this was, we wouldn't be here at all today. That the pure breach of contract case for promising to give you money at the end of the day and you don't do it. But that count also is premised on the notion that there was an understanding, an arrangement, a deal here, that at the end of the day, you do what we suggest you do, you're going to benefit. And all the scheme allegations are supported by that. The third cause of action for unjust enrichment is an allegation that benefits have been retained by Mr. Stout, some, I think, 30% of the $600 million recovery, unfairly. Unfairly because of the scheme. And all the allegations support the third cause of action. The fourth cause of action for promissory estoppel, there was a promise. If you do what we suggest, you will benefit at the end of the day. There is a separate set of facts alleged, let alone a cause of action, and I do agree, Judge Moss, that there is no case that supports, well, really, the phrase we use often is the lesser included offense, that supports a theory of duty to defend where there is no pleading, there's no cause of action.
Well, I guess that as I understand the argument, it is that the malpractice that would not be excluded from coverage is giving the advice of making this transfer.
The legal advice is exactly that. If you don't document your interest, we'll be able to avoid the judgment creditor's execution.
Right.
But the court pointed out, and it's been pointed out by other courts, that this is not something we take out in isolation. It all is part of an integrated scheme. That's what supports each alleged basis of recovery. We cited a case from the First Circuit, Mount Airy Insurance versus Greenbaum, which pointed out toward the end of the opinion that there were hundreds of transactions, and one might take out some and view them independently and perhaps find that they don't, viewed in isolation, fall within an exclusion. But they all occurred over the course of and as part of a scheme, if you will, and so we don't view them in isolation.
But Mr. Howell.
Yes, Judge.
I am. Thank you.
Mr. Howell, it's a scheme. You don't exclude intentional acts under the policy.
This is not at all a question of intentional acts, and I don't argue.
No. But intentional acts are not excluded in terms of coverage, correct?
It's right. There's a criminal provision or what have you, but there's not an actual intentional act.
So the mere fact that it's a scheme, that doesn't get you out of it. It seems to me you have to show, in terms of the eight corners of the document, if you will, the rule, that this is based on a business enterprise exception. And it seems to me that's when a lawyer has commingled his or her business dealings with a client, and in that connection of the commingling, he or she gives legal advice. So legal advice alone won't get you out of it, but if it's business. But here, isn't this different? This is saying that the lawyer took a trust type of relationship and turned it to his benefit, correct?
Part of the allegation is...
But not his business. In my view is, if you do something for a client, you tell a client, I'm holding this property because this is the way we do it, that's not a business venture. That's really, I'm your agent, and I hold it solely for your trust. So how does that become a business enterprise when the lawyer allegedly is violating his trust and holding this property, and you write it there, when the dust settles, you're going to get your share.
Well,
Your
Honor, I think the assertion really starts with the fact that Mr. Stout was the trustee for the company that acted as the holder of all of the assets that mattered of Telefine, and at that time provided advice that was essential to moving this intellectual property out of Telefine and into another company. That's not a provision of advice with respect to I hold my client's property in trust. That's provision of an advice which is, we are going to have a deal here. You, Mr. Andros, the Richards investors, you cannot have any documented interest or else this plan won't work. And all well and good if in fact that's delivered on, I suppose, at the end of the day, but that's not what's pled here. What's pled here is that this never happened. And, in fact, each wrong alleged comes about in connection with two separate companies and one separate, if you will, common law description of a business enterprise that Mr. Stout either owned or controlled or managed or all three. And if it was just an allegation, as you say, Judge Gregory, that I, as an attorney, am holding this in trust for you and I give some advice to you and somehow that results in damage, then that's not what we're talking about. I don't think this is that case. I think this is a case in which...
How else do you explain the collateral agreement, trust agreement, both the which I can't understand. I don't know what was left. You have the collateral loan agreement, then you have the security agreement. Both together said, you're giving up all of your present and future intellectual property. And that was for the benefit of his client, the Richards investors, but Flat Morris had it. The lawyer had no business enterprise. He was just, as they say, he was creating a facility to facilitate an object, which was to protect your investment in a company.
What is alleged is that Mr. Stout had an initial ownership interest in Flat Morris that expanded by virtue of his ability to issue capital calls and deplete significantly the Richards investors' ownership interest until he and his firm had a controlling interest in Flat Morris. Again, a factual allegation that I think is very different from the type of scenario that Judge Gregory is suggesting. This is one in which the scheme led to the control of the company that was initially going to battle off LeaseCo into bankruptcy, and the formation of a company, which was contemplated from the very beginning, that Mr. Stout would control. And the allegations simply have to be, for purposes of exclusion, that in connection with these enterprises, there's a conflict of interest that supports the claim here.
Yeah, but my whole question is that how does this facility creating this will morph somehow into a business enterprise that the lawyer had? What I'm saying is that basically the lawyer can never get a true, as alleged, interest in a company where, under the guise of holding something in a fiduciary duty, you continue, as you said, to amass your ownership until to the point of Blackbird settles and you get 30% of the proceeds. So that doesn't morph into a business enterprise, even if it's a scheme, does it?
Well, there wasn't a morphing. There was a plan. And the plan was to form NTP. NTP was a shell company. Its address was Mr. Stout's firm. He and his partners owned it and their family. And that company was contemplated from the beginning.
Yeah, but you're making the fraud the business enterprise.
Well, there's no fraud alleged, actually, Your Honor.
But that's basically what you said. The breach of the fiduciary duty, you're making that the business enterprise that creates the exception. That's the flaw, I think, in the logic of it. You can never, it doesn't ripen into truth and into something pristine just because you have iterations. It started with the lawyers allegedly saying, listen, let's create Flat Morris. That way we'll get rid of Lisco. Then later on, the bankruptcy signed this and said, you really don't have any interest in it. And then lawyer somehow, is that true? The lawyer got 30% of the BlackBerry proceeds?
It's in the district court's opinion, the amount of money and what the approximate percentage was. The district court didn't view this as something that morphed, and I think this is correct. It didn't morph into anything. It was a plan from the beginning. These patents are going to end up in Mr. Stout's company. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, this would help me. Maybe I'm having the same problem, Mr. Gregory. Maybe you just misunderstand the case. I thought that basically, according to the underlying complaint, everything was going according to plan. There's the transfer. Everything's going fine until the end, when the plaintiffs in the underlying case are being defrauded.
That's
by
right.
The lawyer. But, I mean, they agreed to the transfer to his name because they wanted to avoid the patent problems. Is that right? I mean,
right.
It's not. There's no contention that he pulled a fast one in putting it in removing the stock from their name.
No,
that was part of
right.
their plan. They all agreed
right.
to that. That
that's,
was not fraud.
That's
it,
right.
The
there's
only
no,
thing that comes in is at the end, the only thing that they say that they didn't agree to was his keeping the $600 million or whatever it is.
That's it, Your Honor. You're absolutely right. One question that this calls to mind is whether or not there's a temporal requirement here.
They say that there was an oral agreement that they had with him that
That's
he would
right.
be giving them their money at the end.
That's right. And so
but
we,
they don't dispute any of the earlier. Is that? I mean, the other side is going to have a chance to talk to me. So
no, the advice was a fantastic success. It worked.
And they agreed with the advice.
And they agreed with the advice for the very reason, Judge, that you just stated. Because they were going to get their share of the pie at the end. And with this exclusion, with respect to professional services rendered in connection with business entities, what courts have asked often is whether or not the entity has to exist at the time. Now, the district court made pains to hold that in two respects it essentially did. The company that was formed was contemplated, and there was an informal business enterprise as well. But let me, I don't want to address that in answering your question, Judge. With respect to a temporal issue, the view is, and many courts have taken, that the advice doesn't have to be given at the time the entity exists. The purpose of the exclusion is fairly broad, especially when the phrase in connection with is used. With in connection with, we're talking about whether or not a claim has been made that is in connection with the ownership interest or the management or control of the attorney. And since it was always contemplated that NTP would be formed, and this was the business reason why this was done, this was a company Mr. Stout was going to control. There wasn't any debate at the beginning of this about whether he would control it. That was alleged, that was expected, and that happened. So in that respect, as we read the language of the exclusion and give it its plain meaning, there is no requirement that the particular entity have come into existence. It was planned. It was expected. and the plan worked, except that they didn't get their money, as Judge pointed out.
But so, no, please go ahead.
So what you're saying is that because the advice incorporated this concept of sequential transfers, that by its very nature it could not have had the enterprise come into existence in the beginning.
Well, within TP, the notion was it would have come into existence. Now, I don't want to lose track of the fact that it's not the only entity that the court relied on, of course. Flat Morris existed. Mm-hmm. The association, if you will, that the court determined was also a business enterprise, existed from the time of agreement to accept the advice. The court in that regard said, we have an organized effort, coordinated effort, for the purpose of producing profit. It had individuals with roles, and Mr. Stout clearly controlled it. So there are alternative bases here, but there's one plan, and it didn't change. And it was always a plan.
Well, maybe it did change. But, I mean, there's one plan that everybody agrees on to a certain point.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then the plaintiffs in the underlying case say that the lawyer didn't follow the oral agreement or written or whatever that he made to give them their share of this, or all of the $650 million. I think Judge Gregory had a question.
Yeah, counsel, the purpose of the business enterprise exception was not to weed out claims based on fraud or fiduciary duty. You agree with that, don't you?
I agree with that, Your Honor.
All right, well, so that's not the purpose.
That's
so not all this purpose. Talk about scheme, ab initio, and at the end, or either way, that's not what they're trying to do. Isn't the purpose is that when a lawyer is in a legitimate business relationship with a client, we don't want to be exposed to the legal advice that may be given in connection with their legitimate business interest with their clients. Is that correct?
I don't use the word legitimate when I talk about the purpose, and neither did the district court, which I agree with their analysis.
We're not talking about the district court. We're talking about your policy, your client's policy. Isn't that what they're trying to do?
There's no word legitimate in there, Your
but
Honor.
It covers business enterprise.
It covers legitimate business enterprise. Because otherwise you have an exclusion and say, listen, we're not going to cover anything that's deliberate and fiduciary duty breaches. You don't do that. You say, so we have to, don't we have to imply, even if it's not said, that it's legitimate? You're certainly not talking about legal. It would be against public policy if you were covering, like, we're going to cover you when you go out and sell cocaine or whatever. Obviously you're not going to do that. It's legitimate business enterprise, correct?
Well, the word scheme is used in the complaint, Your Honor,
the exclusion would cover both legitimate and illegitimate, wouldn't it?
I absolutely agree.
I mean, the broadest amount of coverage.
The exclusion would reach both.
Yeah. Right. But here's the question. I'm trying to get. I'm not saying it, but if you're correct, at the end of the day, the purpose was to help facilitate. That's what alleged these clients. How does that become your business enterprise when, as a lawyer, you have no, pardon the pun, business being involved when everything was to facilitate your client protecting their interests, not yours? You can at the end say, well, you know, I had a nice scheme, but I'm the business person here. My intent was to create it for myself. No, the client went along with it all along because we trust you. And this is a horrible case, I might say.
I understand.
If half of the things alleged are true. But
I understand. It,
but to say at the end of the day, you know what? I'm going to keep a big chunk of the $600 million and you get nothing because I'm in a business enterprise. And then you can say, well, you know, it's excluded. How so?
I appreciate the question. I think I understand it a little better now, Your Honor. I appreciate that, and I'm sorry I didn't before. At the time the advice is given, this is the company that held and controlled the asset, Flat Morris. At the time it is given, Mr. Stout is the sole trustee with respect to the holding of that. At the time that is given, Mr. Stout has an equity interest in Flat Morris. It grows later, but the exclusion doesn't require it to grow. And the district court concluded that as to Flat Morris, it found that Mr. Stout and the Amnelli firm did own it in part.
So if he had done what the plaintiffs in the underlying case said he promised he would do, he would still have gotten a portion of the $650 million because he was part of the entity, even they acknowledge.
He would have gotten a portion. I believe that comes straight from the pleadings. I don't think there's any doubt about that, Your Honor.
But I thought the only corpus of Flat Morris was the holdings of the intellectual property of his client.
It was, in fact, the company that was integral in asserting the priority interest in bankruptcy to hold off Lease Co. It was also the company that ultimately was an essential vehicle for...
wasn't it the only corpus was the fact that they were holding properties owned by his client?
It was
intellectual property.
It was an investment vehicle.
He owned a portion... I'm grateful to Judge Gregory because I thought he owned a portion of that company as well.
He did, Judge.
But what were the assets in the company? His client's property.
It's expressly alleged that the asset was the intellectual property that was ultimately moved into
the asset. So what did he own? How can you own something if you're a lawyer? You said, I'm going to create a facility. My client, you're going to put all of your intellectual property in it. How could you have an equity interest in that?
If I've got some shares in that company, I own part of it.
For us saying that a business enterprise is created there by your client?
And if I'm the one person running the show, which it is alleged Mr. Stout was, it's the Flat Morris, yes.
Okay, I understand.
Okay, so that the company owns this intellectual property, and he owns stock in the company that owns the intellectual property?
He has an investor interest in it. That's what's alleged. He has an investor interest. And again, we talk about this, but this is one of the bases for the court's opinion. One of the other bases, obviously, is that there was a business enterprise that didn't have to be a formal corporate entity. That, I think, is consistent with our common law understanding of what a business is and what a business enterprise is. And there are very specific allegations in this complaint that support the court's analysis in that regard.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank
you, Your
Honor.
Mr. Burke, do you have rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to start with a point Judge Gregory made, which relates to the scheme issue. And what really is happening here, as I think Judge Gregory pointed out, is that the insurance company is converting something that's handled by its dishonesty exclusion in this business enterprise exclusion. Because they're saying there's no coverage because there was some scheme, alleged scheme, which of course will be shown there wasn't, and therefore they try to apply the business enterprise exclusion. The proper exclusion to apply in that circumstance would be the dishonesty exclusion, which has protections to innocent insureds such as the law firm. So this is the reason why they're trying to make this argument here, because the dishonesty exclusion protects innocent insureds, while the business enterprise exclusion does not. And by converting the scheme, which is really basically a fraudulent scheme, into the business enterprise, they've expanded the breadth of their exclusions. Now, let me raise something that Judge Motz pointed out when Judge Gregory was saying, well, this exclusion's really supposed to apply to legitimate business enterprises. I think that is what the ordinary person would think when reading the exclusion, and the exclusion has to be interpreted in the most narrow way under Virginia law. You can't interpret this exclusion to overwhelm and to make allegedly fraudulent schemes over decades eat up the dishonesty exclusion, which is what the district...
But if you're in the business with somebody, it seems to me that the exclusion covers it. But, I mean, you can... I take your argument, and you say it only covers it as long as you're obeying the law, and as soon as you become illegal, then you're not covered by the business scheme exclusion, I guess.
Right, you would be in the dishonesty exclusion.
Right.
And there, innocent insureds are protected.
Can I ask you, am I misunderstanding, misreading the record, or is it correct that on the underlying complaint, there's no assertion that the lawyer was doing anything wrong until he ultimately didn't honor his obligation to pay the other people, his clients were clients?
I don't think that the complaint can be read that way because
okay, well,
one
what,
of the...
What did he do wrong before that?
Well, one of the things they allege in the complaint is that Mr. Andros, Andy Andros, filed a statement with the court when there was dispute about the assets of Telefind, saying that Telefind had no interest in these email patents. And they allege that this was, of course, true because Mr. Andros had not documented the patent or the invention. That's the allegation. And so it was the complaint is alleged that it was wrong for them to have even prevailed in that action, and they only prevailed in that action in terms of protecting this email patent by virtue of Mr. Andros having followed this incorrect legal advice. And so
the legal advice may be incorrect as a subject of law, but is there any allegation that your clients did not agree with the legal advice? In other words, their claim is here is against the lawyer.
My clients are the lawyers, not the plaintiffs.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay, sorry, that's all right.
The plaintiffs in the suit did not agree with that. What I'm asking you is to point me to some disagreement they had with your clients prior to the failure to pay over what your clients regard as their share of the $650 million. I thought that
exactly. That's why the business pursuits exclusion can't apply, because the harm has to be caused by a conflict of interest. There's two parts of it.
I really am happy to hear your argument, but could you first answer that question?
I think I did. There is no...
Well,
they
is it
did
yes
it. The
or
plaintiffs
no?
did. Yes. The plaintiffs did agree with this legal strategy.
Right. That's right.
Allegedly.
Right.
So okay, there so was the no conflict of interest.
Then you're saying the harm didn't come from the legal advice.
Well, no, the harm didn't come from the failure to pay out.
How can there be the separate legal claim?
The harm came in two folds. The only reason that they did not have an interest in this patent, they claim, was because they didn't document their invention. That's their claim. Had they documented their invention, there wouldn't have been any... That was the harm was done. As a result of them not documenting...
They agreed to not documenting their invention. There was no subterfuge about that. They were all in agreement on that.
Because of the advice.
Right, understand.
Right.
This same advice could have been given, and ultimately your client paid out a portion of the $650 million that they think they're entitled to, and there would be no claim, right?
Yes, of course. If they received the money, they wouldn't have a claim.
Right.
But the point is that had they not followed the advice, they would have had documented interests. And so, yes, you can say lots of different things and construe and cut and parse this complaint lots of different ways. But the bottom line is they still have a claim for the advice. Excuse me.
You want to hear the question?
Yes.
Okay, good. What I was really getting at is you have a lot of cases where one party makes up documents. That's not this case. This lawyer, your client, didn't make up documents.
Didn't allegedly make up documents, no.
No. The client knew all about these documents, signed on to the documents.
They say that, I don't think there are documents, but they say that
the
they did.
The transfer are documents. The transfer of the intellectual property.
The patent application was made, there was a patent application made by an entity called ESA, and it made that there was no transfer
to it. They knew all about this.
I believe the complaint, yes, alleges that.
Okay.
There was no subterfuge there. The subterfuge.
Okay. I think your time is expired.
Thank you,
Your
Honor.
Finish your sentence.
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Do you have further questions? Okay. We'll come down and greet the lawyers, and then we'll go directly to the next case.